Listen to the voices of our world.
This president said you're either with us or against us, but a couple of countries like Pakistan and Saudi Arabia get to be both with us and against us.
The highest priority should be making use of energy which is given to us free every day.
They really aren't our friends.
Welcome to Voices of Our World, a presentation of this station and Mary Knoll. I'm your host, Eileen Bott. In nature, when two different organisms pair together for mutual benefit, a fungus at the root of an orchid gives the plant needed nitrogen, while the fungus gets carbohydrates. That's called symbiosis. We higher life forms develop symbiotic relationships as well. Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, Prince Charles and Lady Di, George W. Bush and Karl Rove. The exchange can be just about almost anything. Nutrients, emotional support, great PR and pretty children, power, and so on. So when a recent photo op at the Bush Ranch in Crawford, Texas, highlighted a bit of hand-holding between the president and the visiting Saudi crown prince, the marriage of convenience between the United States and Saudi Arabia became the message. Author and commentator Gerald Posner spent 2 years unraveling the ties that bind these two nations for his latest book, Secrets of the Kingdom, The Inside Story of the Saudi-U.S. Connection. We'll talk with Gerald Posner about that alliance, and then with David Morris of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, about ways to break our addiction to foreign oil. A whole new life was created for a tired ancient Latin phrase when actor Anthony Hopkins, as Dr. Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, said,
"Quid pro quo, Clarice."
Aside from the fact that the hair on the back of your neck got a rise out of those words, you became aware of their meaning, a bargain, something for an equivalent something. In the years since September 11th, 2001, visions of WMD, mushroom clouds, and yellow cake have danced in your head in the hopes that the drastic increase in terrorism worldwide and a connection with Saudi Arabia would be rendered less conspicuous. The roughly 50-year quid pro quo between the United States and Saudi Arabia remains rather enigmatic. Now, if you're thinking, no mystery here, the U.S. gets oil from the Saudis and the Saudis get muscle and influence from the U.S., you're right. But you're right about the epidermis of an animal layered in rhino hide. The Saudi-U.S. alliance is very intricate and is uncomfortably analogous with the saying, keep your friends close and your enemies closer. In an article written for the Atlantic Monthly, Robert Baer tells us that in the global economics game known as recycling, the two-way trade between the Saudis and the U.S. has grown from $56.2 million in 1950 to $19.3 billion in 2000, an annual growth rate of nearly 70%. Recently, when Saudi security forces found a sizable stash of ammonium nitrate fertilizer, bomb-making components, just south of Riyadh, you may have briefly flashed back to the long-neglected fact that 15 of the 19 9/11 hijackers were Saudis. The educational system in Saudi Arabia is entrusted to Wahhabi fundamentalist Islamic clerics. Preaching hatred against the U.S. and the West diverts attention from hating and wanting to overthrow the Saudi monarchy. The United Nations Security Council reports that $500 million given to al-Qaeda in the last 10 years came from Saudi Arabia, and 4 out of 5 hits on an al-Qaeda website come from Saudi Arabia as well. The same man who planned the attacks on the USS Cole and the American embassies in Tanzania and Kenya is responsible for the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. The most popular Saudi hero today, to many Saudi youth, Osama bin Laden. The message was, America, get off sacred Arab soil. The definitive guide for sorting out all that is America's tainted partnership with the House of Saud may well be Gerald Posner's new book, Secrets of the Kingdom. Kathy Golden speaks with Gerald Posner.
Gerald, was this a natural jumping off point for you because the book prior was While America Slept about 9/11?
You know, Kathy, it seems like it's such a natural progression, but actually it was really the 9/11 report, the government report on the attacks that got our blood boiling about what I thought they omitted about Saudi Arabia and how they gave the Saudis a free pass. And I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times shortly after the government report was issued, and that wasn't quite enough. And we just decided, you know what? let's go ahead and look at that Saudi relationship with the U.S. and see why they could get a free pass in the 9/11 report. And that's what really led to this book.
Gerald, why do you think any of this was covered up? And what do you think is the most important thing that was covered up that the American public should know?
Okay, overall, I'm a big fan of the 9/11 report. I happen to think that it does a stellar job when it comes to describing what went wrong inside the United States and the FBI, the CIA, other branches of law enforcement, our political will to fight terrorism before the attack, and how the attack was allowed to happen. What they did when it came to the Saudis is they didn't have the resources to really delve into the issues involved, like, do senior Saudis in the Saudi government allow money to flow to extremist groups and or terror groups that are on the State Department's list of terror watch groups? The answer to that, I think, is fairly overwhelming yes by a lot of different evidence, but the 9/11 Commission says we can't find any evidence of it. Even to little items, how money ended up in the pockets of two of the hijackers involved in 9/11 that came from the wife of the ambassador to Saudi Arabia, Prince Bandar, was given to another wife of a Saudi intelligence agent, and then ended up being passed over to the hijackers, all ostensibly for charity and goodwill, possibly true, but the two individuals involved who passed the money on are now back in Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis have always refused to allow American investigators to talk to them. The 9/11 panel just glossed over the point and didn't make an issue out of it. And then there are three dead Saudi princes, all dying of accidental means, shortly after a top al-Qaeda suspect disclosed their names and telephone numbers to American investigators. The 9/11 panel doesn't even mention any of those dead princes, nor cite any of the interrogations from that top al-Qaeda suspect who was captured in March of 2002 in their final reports. I'd love to see the Bush administration push the House of Saud on that issue.
With all the hand-holding going on, that's doubtful.
Yeah, very doubtful. I mean, you know, the thing that's very interesting on that, a perfect example is the Crown Prince comes to Crawford, Texas, and that's a very telling moment when the prince and the president hold hands. That is not just by accident that they decided that there would be that hand-holding. It was that extra symbol of the bond between the two countries. And I will be told all the time by Republicans, well, every American president has behaved this way with the Saudis and given them the benefit of the doubt. All true. Both Republicans and Democrats have always sort of given in to them time and time again. But the real question for Bush is, what should a post 9/11 president do when the country that we're talking about still sends tens of millions of dollars to fund Wahhabi Islam around the world, the most extreme version of Islam that is often the basis for fundamentalism? Should that relationship be different today? And I tell you, I think it should. I mean, you know, this president who said you're either with us or against us, but a couple of countries like Pakistan and Saudi Arabia get to be both with us and against us, depending on what day of the week it is. And for Saudi Arabia, it's because of oil that they're allowed to do it.
Gerald, is it fair to say that so that they can deflect negative feelings in their own country about the House of Saud, that they are funding Wahhabism?
Yes, and it's complicated in the sense that the kingdom was founded on this partnership between the Saud family and Wahhabism. I mean, Muhammad Wahhab had been a cleric in the 1700s who had made a deal with the forebears of the Saud family that sort of put together their religious muscle and the fighting power of the Sauds to unify the Arabian Peninsula, and it took them 200 years, but they did it. It still runs education to this day. The clerics are employed at the behest of the government. They're very intertwined, so that part of the legitimacy of the House of Saud is its tending of the holy sites of Mecca and Medina inside of Arabia and their claim to the Wahhabi version of Islam. In addition, I do think that in the 6,000 male princes of the House of Saud, they are not a monolithic group. And there are some fundamentalists. Although they live a very wealthy lifestyle, there are billionaires like bin Laden who really don't spend money on Ferraris and Lamborghinis and 60,000 square foot homes in Aspen as Prince Bandar does, but instead live a very simple life despite their oil profits. And those individuals are using their money to really support the spread of Wahhabism around the globe. And they are pleased when the U.S. runs into difficulties, or Western Europe does, because they really aren't our friends.
Those three mysterious deaths of the three princes, if you would delineate that a little bit for our listeners, that's really pretty fascinating.
Yeah, you know, it comes from our capture, United States capture of a top al-Qaeda suspect, a fellow called Abu Zubaydah, who was the field commander for Osama bin Laden. At the time that he was captured in Pakistan in March of 2002, He was then the highest-ranking al-Qaeda terrorist that had been caught. And the first thing the Americans wanted to know is, what about any future attack? Do you know what's coming in L.A., New York, Washington tomorrow? He wouldn't even give his name. So the Americans came up with an idea to create very quickly a room in Afghanistan. They would move him to the neighboring country. It's called a false flag operation. It would look as though he was being held by another country, and they decided to set him up with what looked like Saudi interrogators under the thought that the Saudis do real torture, different than what the Americans do, to the point where, you know, you're barely alive, and then they give you a quick trial and behead you. And he would be so afraid of being held in Saudi custody that he would say, I'd rather talk to the Americans. Instead, when Zubaydah saw that he was supposedly in Saudi custody, not knowing that they were really American Special Forces agents, instead of being afraid, it completely backfired. He said, thank goodness it's you guys, and rattled off from his memory the private telephone number that belonged to the nephew of the King of Saudi Arabia, who at that time was 43 years old and the largest media owner in the kingdom, sort of like the Rupert Murdoch of Saudi Arabia. No ties to terrorism that we knew of, very westernized. The Americans went back to Zubaydah, still pretending to be Saudis, and said, you're a liar. And he rattled off from memory two other private telephone numbers of two other Saudi princes, one of them a former military prince, both members of the royal family. And he then gave them the name and telephone number of the head of Pakistan's Air Force, sort of the equivalent of one of our Joint Chiefs of Staff, and said that had been his contact in Pakistan for money and arms for al-Qaeda for years. Now, the CIA, the same wonderful CIA that thought there were weapons of mass destruction inside Iraq, the same CIA that didn't think the Shah of Iran was going to fall a week before he fell, the CIA couldn't decide what to do with it. And so the decision was made at fairly high levels to tell the Saudis and Pakistanis what we had learned from Zubaydah and judge their reactions. And we told them, and they both came back with remarkably similar denials that said, oh, no, you know, this is garbage. It's all false. And then shortly after we told them, lo and behold, all four of those people had some misfortune, to say the least. I mean, the first person named by Zubaydah, who he actually said knew that there would be an attack, by the way, in September of 2001 in America beforehand, Prince Ahmed, the nephew of the king, went into a Saudi hospital for stomach stapling. He wanted to lose some weight. And 2 days later, at the age of 43, he was dead. His doctor said heart attack first, then they said a blood clot. Okay, those things do happen. The second prince, the 41-year-old, Prince Sultan, died in a one-car wreck, no other car involved. He was on his way to Ahmed's funeral. And then 2 days later, the third prince died, the 25-year-old, Prince Fahd. In his case, the official cause of death by the Saudi royal court was thirst, dehydration, 55 miles outside the capital of Riyadh. Fairly unusual for a 25-year-old prince. It was grown up in the Saudi summer to forget to take a bottle of water with him. And then the last person named by Zubaydah, the head of Pakistan's Air Force, Mushaf Ali Mir, goes up in his private military jet. The pilot is changed at the last moment. He has his top aides aboard, 15 of them and his wife. Ear witnesses on the ground hear an explosion. The plane blows up and is gone. And that was investigated by the Pakistan Air Force with no conclusion as to whether it was sabotage or not.
Do you think Americans can beat their addiction to foreign oil? Email us. Go to www.maryknoll.org/voices. Just click on Contact Us or call us at 877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 877-MARYKNOLL. You're listening to Voices of Our World.